Zombies and Vampires with Dr. Bob Curran. Back in a moment as Fright Week continues right here on Coast to Coast AM. Bob, we were talking about New Orleans and why zombieism seemed to make its way that way first. Let's elaborate on that a little bit more.
Okay. As I said, New Orleans and Charleston were two big slave ports built on the slave trade. I would expect that many of the ancient African religions came through those and were sort of amended by the Catholicism, because New Orleans was a large French Catholic city, and began to develop a sort of culture of their own. Now, we were talking a bit earlier about the two strands of voodooism. Some of the plantation owners were French, and some of those who dealt in the slaves were French, and New Orleans was a massive French for a while, with Spanish influences as well, was a French town. But there were also Spanish slave owners, and this is where the subtle definition, or distinction, I should say, between French and Spanish voodoo comes into play. Because we talked about Rada voodoo, which was an old spirit-based voodoo, in which the dead bodies were taken over by the Loa, or by spirits from another world, and that was what powered them, and that was what motivated them, and that was what animated them and made them walk. But in the among the Spanish slave owners and among the Spanish plantations, there was another form of voodoo which was called Petro. Now, this was supposedly done, or supposedly originated, from a slave known as Don Pedro. Now, he, according to legend, he was supposed to drink, George, I would advise you not to drink this at home, not even on Halloween, a mixture of rum and gunpowder. Now, that was apparently that was quite a favorite tipple in the Caribbean, and several pirates, including Blackbeard, used to drink it. But I would advise you not to try it. But this made him dance very wildly. So all the things that you see on the films, you know, of the voodoo ceremonies and with a lot of dancing and carrying on, is Petro voodoo. Now, that flourished in some of what were called the voodoo salons in New Orleans and in Charleston. And just before the break, we were talking about Marie Laveau, mm-hmm. who kept almost a voodoo salon, in which it was said that people came and danced and indulged in sort of, how can we say, salacious practices and things like that. And they became quite fashionable, because not only could you obtain from Marie poudres which would raise the dead, but you could, as part of the voodoo tradition, acquire poudres which would make people fall in love with you, or which would inspire people with lust or things like that. So the places became very fashionable, not only as with regard to the Walking Dead, but also to other things as well. And they began to bring in a sizable white clientele who danced there to get into what might be called native culture. But over it all hung the idea of Le Grand Zombie. Now, the real zombie, and we think of the zombies as the Walking Dead, but the real zombie is a large snake, like a python.
I didn't know that.
And this was supposed to be the embodiment of Dambala Widow, who was an ancient slave or an ancient African god who became later became a sort of slave god, and his mate Azurli Frida. Now, into that whole pantheon were, appeared a number of other characters, for example, Baron Cimeterre or Baron Samadai, because among some of the slave traditions, it was believed that the dead would not rise on a Sunday, but would rise on a Saturday. And so Baron Samadai, Baron Saturday. And all sorts of other characters who were brought in, both from African tradition and both from French and Spanish Catholic traditions. So you had Saint Raymond, who presided over the dead, and you could buy effigies and you could light candles to some, and so you got a whole mixture of both African tradition and French and Spanish Catholic traditions, which all fused together into a sort of voodoo pantheon and began to build in stories about the returning dead, and you could gain control over the dead. And all this all fused together into the pattern which we know as the zombie.
Interesting. Now, what's the main difference, because this is going to lead us into vampires, between zombies and, let's say, the vampire?
I knew this question was coming, George.
How did you know that?
Both of
You're
them.
You're psychic.
I am. You see, it's the leprechaun here.
And, you know, you've got to come back with us around St. Paddy's Day, and we can talk about leprechauns.
Listen, George, nothing would give me greater pleasure, and we'll do that for St. Patrick's Day.
Okay. Well,
that's a firm date. But what's the difference between the vampire and the zombie? Well, this concerns, I think, not only the question of what lies after death, but also a very fundamental psychological question of what would it be like to be immortal? And the zombie and the vampire are both tied in that in differing ways. Because you look at the vampire. Now, the traditional view that we have of the vampire is the suave, urbane, East European account. And that comes from a book which was written in 1897, which has never been out of print. That was Bram Stoker's Dracula, and we always associate, and later with Anne Rice, who spoke about the American, the sort of languid, immortal Americans living in places like New Orleans and things like that. So you have that. And then you have the sort of shambling figure of the zombie, which is actually immortal and doesn't die until it sort of collapses in on itself. But, I mean, some people believe that if you are bitten by a zombie, the sort of zombification might pass on to you. So in that case, in that respect, the person never died. So both of these are concerned with immortality and with what had happened to people after death, after a sort of physical death, because the vampire was supposed to go into the coffin and then supposed to rise up again, pretty much like the zombie. The vampire was supposed to be slightly more sophisticated, although if we look at Romanian folklore, we will see that the notion of the urbane count is not necessarily true. Well, the notions of the strigoi and the moroi, the strigoi in Romanian folklore are what we referred to earlier, the blessed dead, those who have died from a good, having lived a good life and come back from time to time, and are allowed by God to come back from time to time, and the moroi, who are evil and who have the strigoi, who are evil and who have lived an exceptionally bad life and who are animated by evil spirits. and come back. But I suppose the difference lies in our perception, because both deal with the exact same fundamental questions. The notion of the urban vampire, of course, has little to do with the folklore. It comes from Bram Stoker's Dracula, and it is actually an Irish novel, because it deals with all the problems which were being faced around by Irish and in parts of England about the time it was written. For instance, if you look at the notion of Dracula, with the great cape and the sort of aristocratic clothes, this was a problem which was being dealt with regard to the aristocracy in England and Ireland. Because if you think of the other monster of that time, which began to emerge, and that was Jack the Ripper, who was an actual murderer.
Right.
You think of Jack the Ripper, how he's portrayed, and he's portrayed as the sort of what the English would call a toff. He has the tall hat, he has the cloak, and he is a man of substance. So that was you look at Dracula, because Dracula has to sleep in his own earth. Whenever the Demeter is wrecked near Whitby, she is carrying boxes of earth so that Dracula can sleep in his own earth. But that was more to do with the problems dealing in Ireland with land and the acquisition of land. There was a tremendous problem with the English taking over land and the Irish claiming their own earth and things like that. So a lot of the social problems, as well as that, many English landlords in Ireland were described in the literature of the time, and this is pre-Dracula, as bloodsuckers, that they sucked the blood from the peasants. And so perhaps all this feeds into our perception of Dracula, just as all the other things fed into our perception of the zombie. So in answer to your question, George, the main difference between the vampire and the zombie is probably that of perception.
And it's all revolving around death.
It is.
That's fascinating, too. Vlad the Impaler lived out there in Transylvania, I believe, right?
Well, yes and no, because Stoker, you see, whenever he based Dracula on Vlad the Impaler, but Stoker had actually never been to Eastern Europe, and so he relied on a gentleman called Arminius Vambery, who had written a number of things on Eastern Europe. And he got the thing wrong, because the Golden Crone, if you read the beginning of Dracula, Jonathan Harker stays at the Golden Crone, in which is in Bistritz in Transylvania, and you're right. But he travels up the Borgo Pass, now he's traveling out of Transylvania and into Moldavia. So Dracula's castle actually lies in Moldavia. Now, Vlad the Impaler was a 15th century warlord, but not of Transylvania. He was a warlord in Wallachia. And this is getting very technical, and I apologize, George.
That's all right. That's great information.
He was a very stern man. Actually, in Eastern Europe, Dracula is considered a great hero, because he defended Christianity against the influx of the Turks, of the Muslim Turks. He fought a number of battles against the Turks and was considered to be a great hero and a great warrior. But he was also supposedly a very stern man, and he didn't handle his subjects, if you like, with kid gloves. The name Dracula actually means little dragon, and his father had been awarded by the Christian authorities the Order of the Dragon. So he became the little dragon, the Dracula. But as I say, he was a very stern man, and he, for instance, if I can give you an example, he decided to clear his country of beggars mainly Saxon beggars who had come in. And he found a novel way. He invited them all to a grand banquet in a barn. And they all arrived in, and there was food and there was wine left for them. And as soon as they were in, the doors were shut and the barn was set alight. And all of them were burned. And that, said Dracula, got rid of the beggars in Wallachia. He was also considered to be a very generous man. He, to those who supported him, he gave vast wealth. But there is no reference to him drinking blood. Now, you said Vlad the Impaler, and that was a method which he used of getting rid of his enemies.
He impaled them on sticks and things.
He placed them on sticks where he could see them, and it is said that he ate his breakfast while that was happening.
Oh my
God. Gradually, the force of gravity pulled the bodies down, and they were disemboweled or whatever on the end of sharp stakes. And that was supposed to be... But there is no reference to him ever drinking blood. He became associated with that through Stoker's novel.
It's fascinating how these myths in folklore grow into these incredible stories, Bob.
It is, because many of the stories and the myths deal with how we interpret the world. We begin to look, and we're talking about zombies or vampires, and we're talking about Halloween. And Halloween is, whenever you look at Halloween, it's a dark night. I mean, I don't know what it's like out where you are, but last night, this night, I would assume, will be very dark. Cold and
crispy
and very creepy. So you begin to wonder what's lying out there in the dark. It preys on your fears. Nobody knows what lies beyond the very edge of the candlelight or the lamplight or the firelight. There's something lurking out there, and we don't know what it is.
You wrote a book called The Encyclopedia of the Dead. Yeah. Tell me about that.
Yeah, the Encyclopedia of the Undead. That was looking at a whole number of creatures. The subtitle is A Field Guide, once again, to the creatures that cannot rest in peace. We looked at things like, we did look at voodoo and zombies, and the zombies book grew out of that. We looked at vampires, we looked at werewolves, and we looked at another shambling figure which appeared out of Jewish literature, the golem. The golem resembled the zombie in many ways, but was from Jewish literature. And it was said that it was a man made out of clay, and that certain rabbis had the power to create these golem by secret and magical means. And part of the means was actually to write the word emeth, which means life, together with certain incantations from the Kabbalah or the Kabbalah, and the creature would rise up. Now, in order to send it back to its tomb, if you want, or to collapse it, all you had to do was rub out the E-M-E-T-H, emeth meaning life. You rubbed out the E, and you had meth meaning waste material.
Let's talk more about the undead when we come back, Bob, okay? We'll be back. Indeed it is. Indeed it is. Next hour, we're going to open up the phone lines to give you an opportunity to talk with Bob Kern as we talk about zombies, vampires, the undead. Fright Week right here on Coast to Coast AM. Bob, I've got to ask you about what the Sumerians, their views about the zombies and the dead.
Well, there is a great tradition in both Sumerian and Arab culture about the dead. returning dead. You see, the ancient Arabs believed, from which derives from sort of Sumerian belief, that some of the corpses returned, and they were almost gathering together in certain places. Now, it was believed, for example, that in many cultures, that the dead tended to congregate in places. In ancient German folklore, they tended to gather in ancient churches. In Eastern European, there were places like black stones, which were large, standing, almost like standing stones. But the tradition of Sumerian and Arab said that there were places in which they gathered, and that they interacted with certain people, or that certain people could interact with them. Now, and this, I think, comes from ancient Sumerian, though there were people who dwelt in places like the Empty Quarter, the Rub el-Khali, down on the Arabian coast, who could, there was two branches. There was the Fugara, who were sort of healers and things, but there were the Maqarabin, who were the ghost priests, who came and interacted. And the part of this has ancient Sumerian and goes back into even as far as ancient Egyptian, who interacted with the dead, and who could call the dead, if it was like, no, these were the ghost priests who were very mystical and very magical. Then there were a group of people called, who have seemingly disappeared, who were somewhere in the desert, the Great Empty Quarter, near a place called Wadi Rum, which is far out in the desert. And these were called the Al-Saluba, or the Lost Shamans, who actually had power to come and interact and call the dead. And they were photographed in 1920 and have since disappeared. Now, who they were or what, and very little is known about them.
What do you mean disappeared? Where'd they go?
There is no record of them after that. And they were very, very different from the ordinary Arabs. They were more Greek-looking, and it was thought that they were descendants of the army, or at least part of the army, of Alexander the Great, who had come through the area, and that they were privy to various mystical enchantments, and all, many involving the dead, and many involving raising the dead, and many involving calling back the dead. So there were photographs, I think, of them, George, in the 1920s, and there hasn't been one taken since, and they have sort of disappeared from our radar, if you like. They may still be there.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
They just simply vanished.
They were in small groups living in the, I think it was around about the Rub el-Khali, the Great Empty Quarter. Now, that is an area in which is simply desert and very little lives. There is a place way out in it called Wadi Rum, which is a massive stone place. Now, it's like a mesa in New Mexico or in Colorado or something like that. And it was supposed to be a place of great power among the early peoples. And it was supposed to radiate power. In fact, it was supposed to be the site of a city which had been built by the jinn, or the genie, the spirit beings. And it was supposed, in Bedouin mythology, It was supposed to be a place where the devil sometimes came. I mean, you have places all over America where I'm thinking of places, literally because I'm writing a little bit about it, like the Devil's Courthouse in North Carolina and stuff like that, which were supposed to be places of power, or Stull in Kansas, or places like that. But these were places of power where it was believed that the dead could be assembled. Great armies of the dead were supposed to wait for the end of the world or the coming of the Antichrist or something like that. This is in Christian mythology. And yes, there are all sorts of places out there in the East which are centers for the living dead.
What about the living mummies of Japan?
Oh, I thought you might be asking me about that. See, I'm psychic. The leprechauns are telling me what you're going to, the next question coming up, so that I can look it up for you.
I love it. you're ahead of me by a step.
The living mummies of Japan are a fascinating thing, because they're not actually involved with magic or anything like that. They are growing out of a certain religious tradition, the Buddhist tradition, they're to do with holiness, and the ascetic who became a living mummy, because you can become a living mummy. Although the practice has been outlawed since the 1930s in Japan. But this was a symbol of supreme holiness. And you turned yourself into a mummy, a living mummy. Now, the first thing, the ascetic, because it was very holy men who did it. We don't know of any women who did it, but there were very holy men who did it. And in order to show their great holiness, the process involved three stages. In the first, the ascetic was actually to refrain from wheat, flour, or any milk products at all, and was only to subsist on seeds. And these seeds or plants grew within the immediate vicinity of his temple or hermitage. He was to not to take any or very little water. In fact, he was rationed to a tiny cupful every 3 days. And the effect of this was to reduce his body weight and do away with all the moisture that would cause fat. And he became thin and emaciated, as you can imagine. And this first process was to last 1,000 days, which is roughly about 3.5 years. The second stage, the diet became much more restrictive. He was only permitted to eat certain pine needles and seeds of the mukaduki tree, which was actually very poisonous. It was used in the preparation of wood furniture, ornamental liquors, and he was his water intake completely stopped. And strangely enough, whenever that happened, all the parasites, which would normally be on our bodies, died away. It would produce vomiting, intense sweating, and sort of involuntary urination. And this was through taking on these toxin from the tree and the wood polish and stuff like that. All parasites and maggots, which would bring about decay, died as well. And this was to last for another 1,000 days. By now, he was little more than a skeleton, and he looked like one of the walking dead himself. He then took himself off to a small recess or cave, which was then walled up with a tiny aperture through which the holy man could put his hand and ring a small bell. And we're back to the notion of the bells again. Mm-hmm. That was to symbolize that he was still alive. and that he was still living, but he ate nothing. He by this time, all the parasites on his body had died off, as did most of the toxins which had been in his body and had almost preserved his body. So his body was whenever he died, his body was then prepared with some form of preservative, and he was placed on exhibition as a living mummy. And it was considered to be a good luck to come and see him, or to touch him, or to pray to him. The most famous of all these mummies, because most of these mummies existed in northern Japan and in northern Ireland, was in Mount Yudono, away in the north, at the Chorenzi Monastery there. As I said, this was later viewed by the Japanese government as a form of suicide, and was therefore forbidden. But it is said that there are still the living mummies of great ascetics, and people still make pilgrimages in secret to see them, and they're not for public display, but they're kept by the Buddhist lamas, and people make pilgrimages to see them in, secretly, and touch them and worship them, and in return get good luck in their dealings in the world. So,
Bob, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, where do you get your books? I mean, they're wonderful, but where do you find them?
Where
do you buy them? Your books?
Oh, the books. You can get all the books on Amazon. Look me up. Even if you want some of them in Japanese, you can probably find them on Japanese Amazon.
Really?
You can get them on Barnes & Noble. You can get them, as they say, at any good bookseller, although I have never come across a bad bookseller yet.
Well, I tell you what, I love zombies. I'm keeping this one. Normally, I give these books away as gifts when I get them from guests, or when I accumulate them in Los Angeles, I just give them away as contests and things. This one's mine. I'm keeping this one.
It's yours, George, and maybe if I'm over in the States, I can come and sign it for you.
Absolutely. Tell me about the illustrator, Ian Daniels.
Ian Daniels, I was going to mention Ian's wonderful work, because it really is. I have known Ian. In fact, he has worked with me for about 4 or 5 years now. He has worked for a lot of very famous people, such as particularly in science fiction, such as Marion Zimmer Bradley and Poppy Z. Bright and people like that. And his artwork is actually stunning. And whenever we thought about the book, I approached him and I said, look, would you be interested in doing this? And he said, yes, we would. We are very friendly and we have worked together for a good number of years. His work is simply stunning, and I think it adds to the book. It can give you a fright on Halloween night just looking at the pictures themselves.
Yeah, he's done a great job, and I love your color.
Tell
me about, you know, we get a lot of stories about dogs with red eyes. You've got it on your cover. Did you investigate that at all?
Oh, yes. As I told you, it's Halloween here. I don't know whether it's Halloween with you at the moment.
Yeah, it has now become Halloween Day.
Well, happy Halloween to you, George.
You too.
But this is the time when the dogs with the red eyes, these are what are called bar guests. In the north of England, they're called bar guests. But we have a notion that the devil goes about at this time on Halloween in the guise of a great dog with red eyes and dripping fire from the edges of its mouth. And if you meet that on the road on Halloween night, it has the power to take you with it into the afterlife. Most of it I suspect, comes from feral dogs, which were about in the countryside. At one time, man competed, way back in the midst of time, man competed with wolves and things like that, and someday we'll come back and talk about werewolves and stuff like that, but man competed with canines for meat and for game. And in many cases, while a dog is man's best friend, it can also be his worst enemy, because at one time, packs of wolves, particularly in winter time, threatened communities, and I suppose race memories and old communal memories of that still linger. So the notion of the dog with the red eyes and the great teeth is still very frightening, and forms the basis of an, as I say, of another strand, which we'll maybe talk about sometime in the future, the werewolf.
Well, I tell you what, the werewolf is also another great story. I was talking with someone the first hour before you came on about Lon Chaney, who played the werewolf, and you know, that again is another mystery throughout legend, but it's international, isn't it? I mean, all of these are international, most of them starting in Europe.
Well, many of them did, and we talked about things in America, but a number of the ideas came from what were called the what was called the Old World. That was Europe and from Britain. Most of them reflect the preoccupations of the of the early Europeans, and we talked about Dracula being having it. Origins in Ireland. Actually, the oldest, both the oldest written werewolf and vampire story come from Ireland. One in the werewolf from 1185, and the vampire from around 1629 to 1630 in a book which was published there. And just last week, George, I took a group of people up to look at a vampire's grave, which is about 12 miles from here.
Was it eerie?
It was, well, we were up in the middle of the day and the sun was shining, but I wouldn't have liked to have been heading down to it in the middle of the night, and I certainly wouldn't like to be around it tonight. The place is very remote. The place is rather spooky, even in the sunlight. And a lot of the people I had with me were shivering, so you never know what's lurking up.
Did you ever see a zombie yourself up close?
Yeah. I saw what passed to be a zombie. We were doing some work down in New Orleans. This was... I'll let you into a wee secret, George. I am quite fond, quite a big fan of Cajun music. And traveled into the bayous. And yes.
Hold that story. Hold the story, because we're going to take a break. We're going to come right back. We'll talk about this story, and we'll also open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to talk with Dr. Bob Kern, zombies or vampires. I'm George Norrie, and we'll be right back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.